And we are live.
Hello and welcome to episode number 14 of WP Cafe, the show where we chat with WordPress professionals about practical solutions for solo and small WordPress development teams. I'm Keith Devon and I'm here with my co-host Mark Wilkinson. On today's show, we're doing something a little bit different. We don't have any guests today. Instead, Mark and I will be answering a few questions that we've had from our audience. This is a kind of a bit of an ask us anything session. So we've got two pretty big questions to cover, actually. One about our development setup, so Git, deployment, testing, things like that. And the other about our project process, so how we go from first contact with a prospect to actually finishing a project. That's probably going to be enough to keep us busy for today's show. But if you do have a question for us, please leave them in the comments or find us on Twitter at the WP Cafe Show.
So just before we get started, if you don't want to miss out on a single value-packed episode of WP Cafe and more WordPress development content, then please subscribe right now to the High Rise Digital YouTube channel. You should find a red subscribe button somewhere on the screen. That is unless, of course, you're already subscribed. And please like the video if you're enjoying it. You can also find the WP Cafe podcast on Apple and Spotify and other platforms where you'll probably find your podcasts. And you'll find this episode shortly after we've finished here today. And for news on upcoming shows, as well as snippets from this and past episodes, you can also follow us on Twitter. We are at WP Cafe Show. So today's episode is sponsored by the awesome SpinUp WP, which is a modern cloud-based server control panel and is really the best way to own your extremely fast WordPress server, which can be spun up in minutes. Now, SpinUp WP supports any provider, including DigitalOcean, Linode, and AWS. Basically, if your server has an IP address, you can connect it to SpinUp WP. Now, I've been using SpinUp WP for both high-rise digital and personal projects for over 18 months now, and I have absolutely been so impressed with it. It's easy to use, they have excellent support and provides really fast WordPress websites, and I mean really fast compared to some of the other hosts that we have used. At first, I was a little worried about the do-it-yourself approach, but the excellent documentation, support, and even I as a command line novice means that I've really enjoyed it and found it relatively straightforward to use. So if you're looking for a fast way to host your WordPress sites, I couldn't recommend SpinUp WP enough. And what is even better is the awesome team at SpinUp WP have provided us with a coupon link, which gives you guys a 25% off discount for your first 3 months. So if you want to take advantage of that, and I would highly recommend that you have a go at it, because it's quite enjoyable and such a good service, then the link is in the show notes or the description below. So go and give it a try. I'm sure you'll love it just like we did.
Yeah, I second that. SpinUp WP has been awesome for us so far. And actually, we'll be talking about it on today's show, I'm sure. Okay, so we've got two big questions. Mark, I'm just going to throw a bit of a spanner in the works and ask you about... that's all right. Just wanted to ask you about our last episode and any kind of big takeaways. So in our last show, we had the pleasure and privilege to talk to Matt Mullenweg and Josefa Hayden-Tramposi about the future of WordPress. And I've got a few thoughts. I wonder, Mark, how do you think that show went and any takeaways for you?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great to chat with those two. I was a bit nervous, I must admit, to start with, but I thought it went well. We didn't have any technical issues, which was great, which I was worried about, and a good show. Takeaways for me was that I think sometimes I have felt in the last 12 to 18 months that perhaps the WordPress path is kind of defined and not shared, but I came away from that call thinking, no, there is genuinely, open to ideas and opinions and things,
feedback,
and feedback, which was great. That really put me at rest, and that was really my key takeaway. Without watching it back, because it was a while ago.
yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Definitely. I find, like, for me, and it's been something I've been thinking about a bit recently anyway, is that I'm kind of having a bit of a mindset shift now. Like, I think as WordPress developers, we're kind of in this bit of a bubble, and we feel like this ownership over the project, as we should, because, like, we're all kind of contributed to it for a long time, like each of us for like over a decade.
Yeah.
And you start to feel like a bit of ownership and a bit protective of it. But actually what I've realized really is that the developers aren't they're not the target market. We're not the end user. We're just something in between. And actually, like, WordPress, it makes a lot of decisions for the benefit of the end user that sometimes annoy developers and kind of make things maybe a little bit more difficult for us. But at the end of the day, that is, you know, that is who the target market is. And if they're making it easier for people to publish on the web, then they're doing the right things. That can be debated, obviously, but that was kind of one of my big takeaways from it. Yeah, it was a good chat. So I encourage anybody to check it out, and I'd love to hear people's feedback. Hopefully we'll get to chat to them both again in the future.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Okay, let's get into our first question. So, Michael Wrong got in touch. Was this on Twitter? I can't
I believe remember. It was, yeah. Thank you, Michael, for asking this question.
Thanks for the question. So he says, WP dev in Teams, deployment, testing, WP and Git. How can I do this without plugins? What is best practice? There's loads to get into in that question. That's an awful lot, but I think what he's... Okay, I might be misinterpreting the question slightly, because towards the end he says, how can I do this without plugins? And I'm not really sure what he means by that. I don't know how plugins necessarily come into the same conversation as deployment and testing and Git and things like that. So I think, unless Mark, do you have any ideas what he might mean by that?
No, I kind of reverse that to Michael, and how do you do this with plugins? in a way, we don't really use plugins for any of those things, I don't think. Deployment, testing, and WP and Git. Not really, no, we don't use plugins for those things. I suppose possibly you could use some plugins for testing, maybe, but I'm not sure. But we don't anyway, do we? But we can talk about what we do for those things, of course.
Exactly. Well, exactly. So I think, sorry, Michael, if we can't... we don't use plugins, so our answer is going to be how we do it without plugins. So hopefully that'll be useful for you. So I guess we could break this down. I made a few notes. Let me just pull up what I've got. So we could break this down into how to develop as part of a team, our deployment setup, our testing setup, or kind of Git setup, which kind of comes into the team development and deployment. And then we're going to kind of maybe ignore the plugin side of things, because I don't think we really use plugins for any of this stuff. So
just before we get into that, Keith, I just want to say thank you to those that are watching on YouTube. I know some of you have made some comments, so thank you. Do feel free to say hello, and if you have a question, we'll try and get to it. But as I said, we've probably got a full episode, but we'll do our best. So hi to Nick, hi to Joe, and anyone else that is watching along.
Yeah,
sorry, I'll let you carry on.
If we don't get to your question today, and we have enough kind of interest in this kind of format, then we would definitely do this again and cover a question in a future episode. Okay, so team development, Mark, how do we develop as a team? What are some of the things, the processes and systems and tools that we use to make that easier?
Okay, so first of all, we are a very small team. There is literally just me and Keith. We had a few others working with us a while ago, which didn't really change much, did it, in terms of how we worked, actually. But obviously, there's just the two of us. So all of our development work happens in Git, and it happens on, well, not on GitHub, but it gets to GitHub eventually. Obviously, that's how the code is shared between the two of us. Yeah. So each project has a Git repository created on GitHub, and that has actually recently changed, because we used to have literally the entire WordPress project under version control in Git. So that was like WordPress, plugins, themes, everything was in version control, and everything was controlled in that. We've actually moved away from that now, and all we're version controlling is just the custom code that we are writing. So essentially mm-hmm. that boils its way down to usually a theme for the project mm-hmm. and usually one or two plugins. All websites we build have we call it project utility plugin. And that basically includes all of the functionality that's needed on the site that we don't want to tie to the theme. So if it's theme independent as such, and if you were to switch the theme, then it would still be there and available to you. So all that sort of functionality goes in that. So if we're building a new block, for example, that would go in the plugin because we want it available in multiple themes. If we're adding post types and taxonomies, that would go in the utility plugin, that sort of thing. So usually yeah. that's the case. And sometimes there's other plugins that we build. We are taking more of a modular approach to development now. We're trying to make lots of smaller plugins that kind of do one job. And as as an agency, that means we can port those into other projects easier rather than disentangling some functionality from a big plugin on a project. But that's work in progress, and you know we're getting there with that. But that's kind of the setup that we have. Yeah. Then, without going into huge detail on how to use Git, obviously, we both pull that repository down to our local machine and create a local version of the website. And then we tend to use the Git, what's it called, the model that you use in Git?
GitFlow.
GitFlow, thank you. Go on.
I was just going to say, we use the GitFlow model probably a bit less now, don't we? I mean, it's a model that has like a main branch, a develop branch, and then you create feature branches off of that, and then hotfix branches if you need to make quick fixes on production, for example. That was more useful when our team was slightly bigger, wasn't it?
I find
that actually, and this is something to do with being a small team and the fact that you and I have quite different areas of kind of expertise. We rarely actually step on each other's toes too much, and we're rarely kind of working on the same feature at the at the same time. So I don't know about you, but I don't always use feature branches unless I'm doing something a little bit more significant that might affect a lot of a project.
Yeah. I think for me, I do use feature branches. And just for those that are not sure, a feature branch is kind of where you can create a separate branch in your project that you can then, and this is the reason I use them, because I might be thinking, oh, I might want to test how I would do something. So I was doing that recently with some block editor work trying to extend one of the core blocks. If I create a feature branch, I can kind of work on that feature branch and it's kind of separate to the rest of the project, which then means that if I decide that actually that's a lot of garbage and it doesn't work, I can literally just switch back to the develop branch where we're doing all the development work and then just delete the feature branch and forget about it and it's all gone, rather than having to kind of roll back and disentangle things that you might have done. I do tend to use feature branches. I'd like to use them more. I must admit, sometimes I forget to start one and then I'm developing away and I think, oh, I should have started a feature branch. But they're really good.
We rarely share a feature branch, though, do we?
No, we very rarely share a feature branch. So it will be our own feature branch for us, just us, and then it would end up being merged back into develop before you would then maybe take it up with front-end stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and that is something that potentially we can do. We could. I mean, we could take, for example, when we kind of slice a project up into all the various blocks that we need, we could have a feature branch for each block. You do the back end work, then I do the front end work on that feature branch, or like, you know, vice versa. I do the front end first or whatever. You know, we could potentially do it that way. Like, why don't we? Like, can you think? We tend to be just a little bit more fluid than that, but I don't know if that's a mistake or, you know, is that something we should look at? I don't see the problem. You know, if I felt like we were constantly coming up against a problem that a feature branch would solve, obviously, but I kind of can't see what that is right now.
I'm the same, really. I think you tend to change what you do when it doesn't work. So if what we're doing is basically working,
yeah,
then we'd, why change, you know what I mean? And the counter argument to that is, well, if you never try new things, you'll never learn new things that make you better. But I think there's a balance between the two, isn't there? Getting the job done is kind of the most important thing. So trying to make sure that we do it as quick as we can and as efficiently as
we can. I think it comes into the size of a project as well. Like we're a two-person team, so we're not working on absolutely enormous builds, are we?
Yeah.
Where there's just so much going on and loads of people committing code and lots of things changing. And in that case, you might want to have a little bit more control over those changes and the kind of state of the repo at any point in time. But like Mark and I are really, we don't, and if you follow us on Twitter, you'll know this already. We don't kind of chase like technologies for the sake of it. And sometimes I think we're maybe a little bit slow to embrace things, but often actually for our needs, for the size of our team, the tech we use and that we're comfortable with, for the types of projects that we work on, I'm usually quite comfortable taking a step back and not being at the bleeding edge of web development. And I think it's actually a really important thing to say to a lot of people. Like if you're a brand new developer, imagine being a brand new WordPress developer today and going onto Twitter, following a bunch of people in the industry, you'd be put off straight away. You'd be like, what the hell's this? What's that thing? I'm never going to master this. There's too many things going on, too many technologies to learn, too many tools to try to master. And honestly, you can take a simple approach and be successful and absolutely do a good job. And I just think that's such an important message to people in the industry, especially people starting out or in their first couple of years. Like it can be overwhelming. Even for Mark and I have been doing this for 10 years. We're still overwhelmed by it, and we have to take a step back and say, do we need to do this thing? Is it adding, is it actually going to help us, or is it going to cause more complexity and more problems? I don't know if we always get the balance right, but you know, don't be scared to say, actually, I don't need to chase that technology.
Absolutely, definitely. So just coming back to Michael's question then, so that's how we set up a project. Deployment, so this is kind of where our sponsor comes in, Spin Up WP. This is the hosting environment that we use. So they have a really cool feature called Push to Deploy. So what you can do is connect the Git repository to the server, essentially. And then every time we push code to a specific branch, and you can tell SpinUp WP this, it will automatically pull that code onto the server so that it kind of deploys the code straight away for us. And we don't have to do any sort of manually pressing buttons to push the code up. So we set it up where we have a main branch and a develop branch. And every time we push code to the develop branch, it automatically deploys that through SpinUp WP to the server, the development server or the staging site, and vice versa. Every time we push to the main branch, it would push code to the production site or the live server. And that's how that's set up in terms of deployment. We also have used other services. DeployHQ is very good, where they basically do the same thing, but it doesn't rely on the server having that integration with Git. It kind of acts as the middleman to connect your code repository to your server, and it probably uses something like SFTP or SSH to do that connection. But that's really good as well. It's easy to set up. So I'd recommend having a look at that if you want to look at deployments, particularly if you're not into sort of like servery stuff. But as I said, SpinUp WP makes it really easy. I'm sure other hosts have versions of that as well. So have a look at others as well. Whatever your host you're using may well have something that you can use as well. So that's the deployment side of things.
So
we kind of work away in Git, committing stuff as we've done it and tested it, and then obviously that gets pushed to the server where the client can see it and test it. In terms of testing, for me, it's probably more testing for you, I think, isn't it, Keith? I mean, I test stuff, but like front end tests in different browsers and different devices and things. How do we go about that?
Front-end testing, I mean, I luckily it's getting easier.
Is that because browsers are getting very similar?
Yep.
Or they just kind of work?
I mean,
or?
Yeah, I don't need to worry about IE6 anymore, for example, which is great. That's been a long time ago now. Yeah, so the browsers are getting better. And unfortunately, in a way, the browser landscape is consolidating. Everyone's using Chrome. So, yeah, that kind of makes things kind of a little bit easier. And Internet Explorer, like I said, is dying off. I think they've set an end date for IE11. Was it next year? Is it sometime next year? I can't remember.
Yeah, WordPress is dropping support for it, isn't it, as well? WordPress 5.8, I think, which is the next major version, is dropping IE11 support. Yep.
Yep, that's right. So, yeah, luckily, like, fewer clients have wanted to or needed to support that browser, so that makes things a little bit easier too. So from the from a browser point of view, I have a lot less problems than I used to. But then there's still all the devices, the screen sizes that we have to test for. So what I have is a spreadsheet of browsers and device combinations and key pages in a project or templates or blocks or whatever it is, however I'm going to run the front-end tests. And towards the end of a project, I will go through each of those pages or templates in each of those device browser combinations, usually using browser stack, unless I can use the native combination on my machine. I use browser stack for that and just go through each one and check them off one by one. If there's any issues with them, I add those to our Trello board and try to get those fixed. But like I say, it used to be a really significant part of a build, and it's much less so now. Yeah. I think it's partly because I've got a bit better as well, so I can kind of see some of the issues coming down the line, but also just because the browser support for so many features and properties is so good these days. So it's not too difficult.
So something we also do, not necessarily front end as well actually, is that like getting the clients to test it as well. I think some agencies are quite wary of that, and like they don't want to let them see something that might have bugs in it. But I think there is a point where you probably wouldn't want them to see it. I understand that. But once you've got that, made that decision that actually this is pretty much ready now and I think it's right, then get people mm-hmm. using it. Like the more people use it on different devices and like go and break it. Tell me why you broke it and how it's broke, and then we can fix it. If you were testing it in your own little environment, like you'll do the things you know works, and therefore you won't break it. So get as many people on it as you can is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this comes back again to what I was saying about not being on the bleeding edge of all these technologies, because we're, it's only quite recently that I've really started to use CSS Grid, for example. It's been around and available for years.
Yeah.
And people are saying, get onto Grid. It's the best thing ever. Yeah, it is. Like, it is the best thing ever, but it wasn't that well supported until recently. And you had to jump through a lot of hoops to get that stuff working on those older browsers. And we already had techniques that worked.
It worked,
and that gave us the layouts that we needed. So I was maybe again a little bit slow to jump onto Grid, but it also meant that I didn't have to go through all those teething problems and issues with those older browsers. And now whenever I'm kind of ready to do it, it's really well supported, and I just jump in and it works and it's great.
I think what's interesting and important to tell the listeners as well is that although we made decisions like not to use these things at the time, so like 12 months ago we weren't using CSS Grid, it wasn't that you weren't aware of them and you weren't researching them, etc. Because like the number of times you've come on calls to me and sort of said, oh, I think I'll use CSS Grid for this, and then 10 minutes later we've talked ourselves out of it. So it's not like we're not trying to learn and trying to get better at all these things and understand how they work. It's just that it's about making decisions that are right for you at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just not feeling kind of pressure of the industry on you to do these things, which is difficult. And then the other thing on testing I'd just say is, as I go, like this is just from a front end kind of CSS point of view, as I go, I'm constantly like testing all the different screen sizes, just, grabbing the browser resizer and just constantly doing that. I'm always thinking about how things are going to look responsibly. I try to develop mobile first, so that kind of means a lot of the problems that might be there if you developed kind of desktop first and then suddenly you loaded it up on mobile and you're like, oh, you know, it's much easier the other way around. So
always keep
that in your mind. But we don't know that's what Michael was asking when he was asking about testing. So what other kinds of testing might he have been talking about? I was thinking maybe like general kind of QA functional testing. Then there's all the stuff that we don't do, unit testing and things like that. There's things like, you know, linting. There's all the kind of automated tests you can run on deployments. We don't do a lot of that. There's visual regression testing. There's all kinds of testing.
We started looking into that sort of thing, haven't we, with like services that take screenshots and compare and things like that to make sure that when you deploy it kind of looks as it should do. But something that's a bit in its infancy with us, but certainly something worth trying to explore a little bit more.
Yeah, I'd really, really like to get that set up, actually. And I put some stuff out on Twitter recently about that and had a few good resources thrown back at me. So I'm kind of currently looking into that. And it's something else I'd love to do in a future episode.
Yep.
Cool. Visual, especially the visual regression stuff.
Yeah, good. Shall we move on to the next question?
Yeah, let's do it. Have you got it in front of you there?
I have, yeah. So this is a question from Weberson on Twitter, so thank you for the question. And he said, hi, Keith and Mark. Here's my question. How's your development process? And I mean, since the first contact with the client to delivering the project, do you have a scope, a wireframe? Do you approve it with the client? Do you create the layout in a PSD or on Adobe XD, etc.? So I think this is kind of like not just the development side of the project, but like the entire project. How do you go about it from the very first contact with the client all the way through to actually delivering the end product as presumably a website, a WordPress site in this instance? So go for it, Keith.
I told you there were two big questions, right? Oh my goodness. So yeah, it's kind of like the big project process. Well, the first thing I think we need to say is that we are always changing and experimenting, and I don't think any two project processes has ever been the same.
Yeah,
and that's probably in a lot of ways not a great thing. It'd be really nice to like have a really streamlined, you know, battle hardened process that we know just works, but especially for the type of work we do, that's really difficult. I think that actually may be a bit of a cop out, and actually we probably could tighten up the process, but we do like to experiment. So it changes, it's flexible, it depends on the project, but we do have I guess some things that we try to do in some kind of order. But basically what you're trying to do is get from hi, I need a X to here's your X. And the first thing you need to figure out is what is that? What is X?
Yeah.
What is that thing that a prospective client is looking for? That is the hardest bit, isn't it, Mark? Like,
yeah, actually, because what prospective leads tend to do is they'll come and say, hi, I want you to build me a WordPress website, for example, let's just say that, or I want you to build me a forum or whatever the functionality might be.
Yeah.
And actually, most of the time, our response is why? Like, what are you actually trying to do? What is that thing trying to deliver for you? And not always, but sometimes, what we actually deliver is not actually what they've asked for, because actually what they asked for won't deliver what they actually want. And that's important to try and get to the crux of the matter in terms of what are they trying to solve? What are the problems they're actually trying to solve? And those first few email exchanges are often quite difficult, because we ask a lot of questions, which we really need to do to be able to understand what the client is trying to achieve. And I think sometimes clients can, like, they just want a quote. They just want to literally, like, I understand that, but we can't, sometimes just can't give that, because we don't have enough information, and it's about trying to obtain that information.
Yeah, and I think one of the first things that you need to be trying to kind of get to the bottom of is this a serious inquiry, or is this someone who's just putting out some feelers to get some approximate costs and just like test the waters and maybe even get a bit of advice and for free? And like, you know, I think we all do it in like various areas of our life. Like, you know, if I want to go and get a landscaper for the garden or something like that, you know, I have no idea how much landscaping costs, so I'd probably phone up a few and just start asking them how much do things cost without really putting much thought into what I actually want yet or need. So I do get it, but it's important, isn't it, for us to kind of guide that and bring it back to those kind of really important questions of why are you doing this? Like,
and I think
what's the point?
If Weberson's looking for answers in terms of like, what questions should I ask? One of the questions we ask quite early on is, can you send us the project brief that you've got? Mm-hmm. And if they have one, then it does show that it doesn't really matter what that looks like, actually. But if they have one, it really does show that they've thought about what they want and why. If they don't have one, then they're probably just feeling for a price and looking for a bit more information about, you know, whether you're the right sort of team for them. So if they have one, then great. We obviously ask them to provide that to us, and we'd have a look over that. And then usually that would go then along the lines of, well, that's great, thanks for that. It's not quite detailed enough, so we'd need to actually make that more detailed. Or it could be coming along the lines of, well, actually, most of our projects start from X, therefore, is that within your budget type thing? And then that would they then come back and say, well, yeah, that, you know, that was roughly what I was thinking, or that's the budget I've got. Or they come back and say, well, I'm sorry, that's just way too much, or whatever. And then that kind of sort of filters them out on that stage. And then once you get to the stage where they haven't committed to anything, but you know they've got a budget for the project, and you know they've kind of thought about what they want because they've got a specification. Our process is then to sort of usually try and pad out that specification with them, and usually that's part of the project. So the first part of any project will be a project discovery phase, where we actually try and build that specification or project brief, if you like, so that everybody knows exactly what we're actually doing in this project. And that's where we go into those why questions, what you're trying to achieve, why we're doing this, and then work out the best way of actually doing it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm trying to get, then you've got time to get into some of the details as well, to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and then really come up with a plan, for like a roadmap for the project. So like at the very start, just to kind of summarize that, you want to kind of qualify the leads as quickly as possible. Like, is this a serious prospect? Do they have the right budget? Do you have the right skill set to deliver? Once you kind of are 80% happy with that stuff, you want to be getting to a stage where you can give them a price kind of as quickly as possible. So you need as much of that information as possible. Like Mark said, we usually give an estimate early on and then offer a discovery project to kind of turn that estimate into a fixed price. So we would quite often give a fixed price at the end of the discovery.
And part of that discovery is that if they've agreed to a fixed price, we try and make the discovery so that it sticks to that fixed price. So if during that discovery they sort of say, oh, actually, let's add this and let's do this and let's do that, and we can then say, well, yeah, we could do that, but that's just going to take you way over that fixed estimate that we've given you.
Yeah.
And they might say, that's fine, absolutely fine, let's quote it up and do that. Or they might say, well, actually, okay, we want to stick to that budget, so let's find a different way of doing that, or let's just not do that for now and perhaps do that in phase two.
Yeah. I'd be, just like a word of warning, I'd always be wary of clients who want quick fixed prices for really ambiguous scope. So if you're not, like, if they're not prepared to give you the detail that you need, but they want you to guarantee a price, I'd be really, really wary. Yeah, massive
two
red flags. Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, let's assume then that we've gone through that process. of the Discovery. So they're now maybe a client of ours. The next kind of stage would often be design.
Before you come on to design, yep. Let's just say after Discovery, we've now got a document that maps out what we're actually building for them and how it's going to work, as detailed as possible. And then that's what we all agree on, right? The project is this. Yep. This is what we're doing. Yep. Carry on.
Absolutely. And the reason this is so tricky is that, you know, you can agree on a bunch of stuff there and get a technical specification potentially, and then you've got to do some design work, and then more kind of questions are uncovered as part of the design process, and more ideas are generated. So that's maybe a whole different conversation is how you can control the kind of scope of a project. But let's talk about design then. We will do projects where we're delivered full designs or partial designs, or we'll do all the design work ourselves. So we don't have a kind of set part of this process. Like we're happy in all those situations. For a long time, we didn't do really any design work, did we? We tried to work on projects that were designed for us, and we would just come in and do the development work. But that's changed.
It's worth mentioning, when Keith says we'll do the design work, he doesn't mean me.
Yeah. So it's changed slightly. I think I wanted to, like, I love tinkering with, you know, Sketch and playing with things, but I'm not a graphic designer. But I think I can turn a decent brand into a decent web design. Like, I think Definitely. You don't have to be like a fancy graphic designer to be able to do that. Although whenever I see certain designs out there and I think, yeah, I would never have the creativity or skills to like deliver something like that. But for most kind of corporate websites, I think, you know, I've got the skills to do that. And actually, we're doing that more and more these days, because with the way WordPress websites are built today, we have to work with WordPress. I think this is fair. We have to work with WordPress more than we used to, in terms of like design structure and like page structures and things, because of the block editor. I think beforehand someone could deliver us a design and we'd say, okay, that's fine. We'll create these templates. These templates will have these custom meta fields. They may be flexible, they may not be. Like, you know, before ACF flexible content, pretty much every template was fixed unless you're doing things in short codes and things like that. So that whole landscape has changed a lot. And actually, and this is something that Bill Erickson said whenever we had him on the show, design, like being part of the design process, can actually make the whole project so much easier, because I know what WordPress gives us out of the box. I know it's got, you know, a media and text block and columns and groups, and and we can build pages in this way. I can work with WordPress rather than kind of shoehorning it into a design that's completely disregarded what's going to be, you know, how it's going to be put together. So we are doing a lot more design work these days, but I still love working on other people's designs, because often they're better than mine. And it's a bit of a challenge, I think, because I do know WordPress and I am thinking about Gutenberg while I'm designing. I maybe don't think outside of the box sometimes. So sometimes I love it when we get designs like, how on earth are we going to achieve that? And then it's a bit of a challenge and a bit of fun. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't want the whole project to be like that.
Yeah. And that's like, you can design anything and you can build anything in WordPress, but like literally sometimes we get designs from clients and like there's something on the design and it's like, actually, if you changed this one tiny thing on that design, it could literally save you thousands of pounds, because there's something in WordPress that will literally do that out of the box with a little tweak, rather than building something completely bespoke. And it's hard for clients to get their head around that, because I understand, you know, why is it so different? Like, literally just changing that one small thing and it's literally changed the cost by so much. And that's something that's, and we're just really honest with them and just say, you know, why don't we change that, or and so on. And I think, just come back to your design as well, I think like that's something else we're really honest with in terms of design. Like, we totally ask the client what sort of design you're looking for. If you're looking for it's all singing, dancing, fancy graphic design, then we shouldn't really be designing it. I think Keith would probably agree with me there. But if we're looking for a nice corporate looking website that's built around a brand, yeah, we can pretty much do that, which is good.
Absolutely.
So then we essentially, that gives us a set of designs. Usually it's some page layouts, which basically are designs for every block. And then we collate those into some pages that we can show the client to say, look, this is what your homepage could look like. This is what your about page could look like. This is what your blog page could look like, etc. And while that's taking place, I can still crack on with development. So the specification that we've produced from Project Discovery will essentially say, you know, we need a case study section, and therefore I'll be building a post type and associated taxonomies and anything else that's necessary for that, kind of building the architecture behind the scenes. And then once the designs are ready, any back-end development needs to happen based on those designs is then done. And then obviously the front-end development can start to happen at that point in time until we've got a finished website and we've tested it like we've just been talking about, etc. And that's the sort of the process. You did mention wireframes. Yeah. Do we do wireframes, Keith, before the designs?
Yeah, well, that's part of the design process, isn't it? So we normally would do that. Again, like the fidelity of those as in how detailed those are, changes project to project, and really how useful they are these days in the land of blocks. I'm not so convinced, because typically, and this is important actually, is we're not designing content for people. So we don't usually do like what you might call UX work. So like persona development and user journeys and things like that. So usually if someone needs that level, they'd quite often have worked with a UX agency or a design agency and then delivered the designs to us. So we provide the base, you know, the building blocks of putting pages together, and what we really, really want, if we're doing the design work, is some content. And then I can kind of think about how that content can be laid out on a page. Sometimes the client will come with some ideas. A project we're working on at the minute, the client has, they came to us with, it was somewhere between a wireframe and a mock-up, wasn't it? What they delivered. But it was a really strong indication of how they wanted the pages laid out, and then basically I kind of tidied that up and applied the branding to it, and made it look hopefully a bit prettier.
That's good.
That's
good. Looking forward to that one launching. It'd be nice.
Yeah, me too. I think we should do a little show and tell of that whenever
it's
ready. Yeah,
good. That's good.
Yeah.
I hope, Weberson, that answers the process. In terms of what we do to deliver a project. I know it's really hard to go into every detail so on this, but I think we should probably get onto some questions from the audience on YouTube. Might be good.
Ooh.
So I don't know if we've got any. I think we've had some, so I'm just going to have a quick look through my list here. So Joe asks, I saw Mark was experimenting with extending core blocks recently, and I feel the same frustration about the amount of work and complexity involved compared to something like ACF. I suppose that's more of a comment than a question. Do you think it's worth it for custom projects built for just one client, or is ACF the approach you will continue to use? That's a great question. The honest answer is, at the moment, I don't know. At the moment, ACF is the go-to solution that we're going to use for block-based customizations. This particular example was the design we've currently got. The answer is, for this particular image on the design, the answer is actually for 98% of the needs, we can just use an image block. But actually, to make it work, we need to do something with the image block to give the user a little bit of control about the image. So the reason why I've started this whole investigation was that, like, can I add that to the core block? Because actually it's tiny, and actually we'd be replacing 98% of what's already there with a custom block, which just doesn't seem sensible to me. So that's why I was looking at that. We could very, very easily just create an image block with ACF that does exactly what we want. And you know what? That might end up what we actually do. It just doesn't seem to be the right sensible approach to me, and I just wanted to investigate what would be the implications of trying to do that with a core block. And it's interesting. I've enjoyed looking down the road of how to do that. It's quite quite difficult, quite complex. I guess everything's complex until you know it. but it's certainly worth looking into, and something that I'll hopefully either do a video on or do a blog post on, or something to sort of show my findings and what I've actually learned about it, which is good. So thank you for that, Joe.
I just want to say on that point, we do try to use native blocks as much as possible. We feel like that's a really kind of strong approach. It's not a brilliant user experience if they type into the kind of block search to type in image and they've got like four different image blocks to choose from. So we try to use like styles and sometimes variations and just sometimes like the order of the way blocks are placed to achieve certain layouts and styles. But yeah, in this case, we just literally want to add a single field, don't we?
We do. Worth mentioning is that I did a talk, I think it's on a YouTube channel. It's the 10 things we've learned from building with blocks. And one of those was like some of the things that we haven't used yet. And one of them was block variations. The terminology of all this stuff is extremely confusing. And Tom, thanks Tom, answered me today and just said like you could possibly use variations for some of this stuff, which is essentially you can use the same block, but you provide variations to that block. The best example that I can think of is the column block. So as soon as you add a column block, you then choose a variation, which basically says how many columns you want. And you can choose either that like half and half, 33-33-33, or 70-30, which is actually 66-33, isn't it? Which is a bit weird. Anyway, so that's something that you could look at, possibly. But yeah, it's been an interesting experience and something I'm certainly going to keep going with and try and get better at. Which is good. That's what we should be doing as developers, trying to learn as much as we can. Next one was Nick. If you have time left over, I was going to ask if you can share a bit about how far you lock down the block editor to help clients avoid well-meaning design atrocities. I like that question.
Yeah, I like that. Thanks, Nick. We've struggled to lock it down, haven't we? It's not easy.
Yeah. I guess it depends what you mean by lockdown, like as in like fix blocks to certain pages in certain orders. We haven't really gone down that road at all.
No.
We tend to take more of an approach that we will make the blocks that are available, and we do restrict which blocks are available. So we take a whitelist approach where we say this site supports these blocks. So for example, we don't do anything with the verse block, for example. That well-known and well-used block. We don't do anything with that one, so that's not on our whitelist. And therefore, our job is to make sure that the blocks that we are supporting just work. Like, it doesn't really matter what you do with them. They work. So, I mean, that leaves it up to the client to say, well, if they want to make that bright orange when your colour palette's greys, then they can. But we do provide things like a colour palette, which makes, you know, it's basically saying to them, pick from these colours. But they can stick a custom colour in if they want, I guess, that sort of thing.
Yeah. There's a lot that I would love to be able to strip out. And I was going to say, I'm sure there's ways to do it. I'm actually not sure there's a way to do some of these things. But for example, I'd love to be able to remove the button border radius option.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to remove the font size kind of pixel option. And just have like the set font sizes, like medium, large, extra large options. So things like that, because then you can lock it down to a style guide rather than just this open book. And that's always my big worry with the direction WordPress is going, is that, you know, for example, I think there's a dimensions panel coming soon to the block editor where we can change the margins and paddings on nearly everything, which sounds a lot too much like Divi for my liking. And I worry about that level of control, and I think that's probably what Nick's talking about. On the recent theme that we've been building, I've done a lot of work with spacing, and I find that that's hard. And what I actually did, we've removed the spacer block.
Yep.
And I didn't really realize this until recently, but like, I think that was a really, really good idea, because we often open up access to a project to the client like midway through, so they can start adding content, experimenting with the block editor and things like that. And if they'd had the spacer block to play with, they would have tried to fix all the spacing issues with the spacer block. That would then lead to me not detecting the spacing bugs. So yep. I want blocks just to work. You just drop them in and they look right.
Yep.
So I wouldn't have detected loads of the bugs. And then if I did detect them further down the line, fixing those bugs would cause all kinds of spacing issues anytime there was a spacer block used. So top Gutenberg development tip, don't remove the spacing block until the end of the project. And drop it in at the end. I think
we'll probably give the client the spacing block, because ultimately there are probably thousands of scenarios where blocks could be positioned, and I genuinely think a spacing block might be useful. But like he said, don't give it them, because actually our goal is to make any block work with any block when it follows it and so on. So we want to try and make sure that the client has added those blocks and they just look right, and they haven't used the spacer block to make it look right. So like he said, we can make sure that works, and then provide that at the end of the project.
Yeah, I just want to just add as well, just to Nick's point there about locking it down. So Mark said that we do a whitelist approach for blocks, so we don't allow all of the blocks. We've also removed some of the styles, like the default block styles, and I've also changed and in some cases removed some of the alignment options. So that's something that you can do, but I'm kind of discovering all this stuff as we go, so I'm sure there's a lot more that we can lock down, Nick, but hopefully that's helpful, and hopefully we'll do this show and tell sometime soon and show some of the stuff in more detail.
And Nick just mentioned, he said, oh, perhaps you don't as in don't lock down and instead rely upon training. Training is an important thing, actually, and we've learned that on this project. WordPress is very different now to it was 2 years ago when people were editing content, so you do need to inform the client, and it does have some little quirks when you're editing content that they need to be aware of and things like that. So just a quick example of that is like selecting a block or a wrapper of a block, a group, is not particularly easy. So like showing the client where the block breadcrumb is just really helps them. It's like a light bulb moment for them. Oh right, I can select the group now, just click it on down there. Definitely some training is certainly worth mentioning or doing with your client, for sure.
It doesn't have to be extensive either, just some of those basics on an hour long call.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can go a long way.
Yeah. Sam Berry, thanks Sam, says, with Gutenberg in mind, do you design full pages or do you just design blocks required to build those pages? I think you're better answering that, Keith.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually still end up designing pages just because I feel like designs have to work, you know, as a whole. And if I just like opened up Sketch or whatever I'm using, I haven't switched to Figma like everyone else has. So if I open up Sketch and I say, okay, I'm going to design the heading blocks, and I designed some really beautiful heading blocks and they all look great, all sat next to each other on this page. Okay, next page, I'm just going to work on my paragraph blocks now. That's no good. I mean, those two pages could look great on their own, but put those headings and paragraphs together and they still have to look good. They have to relate to each other and look good. So I still find that design, you know, yes, you want like a typographic system, you want a grid system in place, you want a color palette to work with, it's kind of the design kind of fundamentals, but I just find it so much easier actually designing pages but with blocks in mind. I rarely just deliver designs of just here's the such and such block, here's the such and such block. It usually still is in pages or templates,
and with the caveat of course that the client can then go and essentially design their own pages with the blocks,
course,
if they want to do that, and our job is to make sure that when they do that it works and it looks right. So that's exactly, that's where things have perhaps changed slightly a little bit.
Couple more.
Salams has added, how have you guys looked into building a headless WordPress site? The very short answer to that is no. And the question I would ask is, I really can't understand why I would want to do that. Because WordPress gives you so much stuff that you just don't get with a headless site, and the kind of projects we build, I cannot see why we'd ever need to do that, certainly in the near future. But it's there, I mean, and if you want to use it, is that what your thing is? Go do it.
Let's not get into it too much, but I think the classic reasons to go headless are because you can swap out the front end anytime if you ever think you might do that. And they can be a lot faster and more secure if you're using kind of like something like a static site generator on the front end. So there are reasons. They just haven't, for us, we haven't felt the need to. Who knows? Yep. Maybe we will.
Let's go for the last one, which is Sean M. Thank you for your question. He says, block patterns, block styles, block variations. What do you, where do you use what and when? It's a question.
Good one.
Very good one. So we use block patterns, and block patterns, for those who don't know, essentially you can build a collection of blocks on a page, and then you can have that available just to drop on any other page where you make it as a pattern. So here are a load of blocks that fit together, and they're now a pattern. They differ from reusable blocks because once you drop a pattern on a page, you can edit it. So you can delete one of the blocks, you can change content in those blocks, etc. A reusable block is more like a template. So you would create a reusable block, and that gets used on multiple pages. And if you change it once, it changes on all the pages. That's not a block pattern. So if you've got a section of your page, common one is above the footer, you might have like a gallery of client logos. And that's literally going to be across lots of pages. And when I add a new client, I want it to be across lots of pages. Then that would be a block. No, that'll be a reusable block. Get that right? So that's a great example for that. A block pattern is where perhaps you've got like a call to action section, which has got a group with a color behind it, a heading, a little intro, and a button. You want to use that pattern across the site. You want to make sure that the group's got the same background color, the heading's got the same color, the text looks the same, the button looks the same. But you want a different heading, a different paragraph, and a different button label and link. So that would be a pattern to say, look, I'm just going to drop this pattern on the page, and then I'm going to edit the contents of this pattern. That's a great example of where you'd use a pattern. So we do those. Block patterns, unless someone can correct me, you can't create in the WordPress UI. You have to create those with code. Something I'd like to see, we have like a add to reusable blocks button. Wouldn't that be great to just say add as a block pattern? And then you've got that in your library as a block pattern. As a user, you could do that. Maybe that's something that, well, I can't build it, but maybe someone else can. And maybe that will be built, I don't know. And block variations is something we just mentioned before, really. We haven't really used them yet, but having my investigations over the last 24 hours, it's certainly something I want to have a look at and see if we can use them a little better. Definitely.
Block styles as well. You didn't mention those.
So I forgot block styles.
We do heavily use those.
Massively,
For loads of different reasons. So I'll have like headings. I've got heading block styles. So for example, I can make an H2 look like an H3, so we can have the correct semantic markup structure, but you can achieve the kind of visual hierarchy that you want. We use them in lists a lot, so you could have like tick lists or star lists, as well as like bulleted lists. You could have inline lists instead of vertical ones, all sorts of things like that. So yeah, we really make use of styles. I'd love to see multiple styles being available, so you can select large list and tick list rather than having to create
a large tick list.
Yeah, or on a small tick list or regular list. So yeah,
possibly that's where variations might help us, but I'm not sure that
feel quite right.
It doesn't feel quite right to me, but it will be interesting to investigate that, certainly. So we'll see.
Yep. I think we should wrap it up. We're nearly at the hour.
We are. Thank you to everyone for their questions. That was really good.
Yeah.
Who's doing the outro? Me? Are you?
I don't know. There's not much of an intro today. We don't have any guests to thank. So thank you, Mark, for your time today.
And thank you, Keith, for your time today.
I would say if you did enjoy watching this, we would love a like. If you do want more content like this, please subscribe to us on YouTube. where you can also watch us live, and you'll get notifications if you enable those, or you can subscribe to our podcast these days wherever you get your podcasts.
Definitely.
Anything else from you?
Thank you again to our sponsor, which is SpinUpWP. So if you're looking to investigate some new WordPress hosting and you want something super fast, then I would highly recommend having a look at it. And there is a link to a 25% off discount for 3 months in the description or the show notes below, depending if you're listening or watching to this at the time. But yeah, thank you to those for sponsoring. It really does help us out and enables us to bring these shows to you guys.
Yeah, and thanks for watching and listening, everybody. We really appreciate it.
Yep. And we will see you next month for something else when we decide what it is.
Yeah. See you next time.
See you next time. Bye-bye.